got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, how are you? How are things? How's life?
It is good. Now today's just, well, we usually record this on a certain day of the week, and this week we kind of punted on that. So today's Saturday, and it just, you know, I'm just all discombobulated with respect to the podcast because, you know, I get up at six, I take care of the animals, make sure Talking Biotech launches correctly and promote that, then have to be loaded up for the farmer's market by seven, do that all morning, and then get home and do work. So today I am like detoured from my usual schedule, which is okay. So all good. Everything moving forward.
Yeah, it's just life. There's more things to do than you have time to do them. But everybody gets by. So here we are. We're doing the show. We're doing the show. That's all that matters.
I did have one brilliant idea this week, in that to get more time, I'm going to change my name officially and legally to Scam Likely. Because I'm thinking that, you know, all these people say like return the phone call, and then I call them and then their caller ID says Scam Likely and they don't pick up. And I called you. And they go, well, yeah, but I didn't see you called. I said, yeah, I called right here. You didn't pick up. So that's like my new idea, is to shun responsibility. So, you know, there we go.
I think that's better than perpetual pets, to be honest. I would, I'd run.
No, I'm going to totally do it. I'm changing my name to Scam Likely.
Yeah, that's good. And then you can blame it on AT&T or Verizon. You're like, I don't know why they would call me a scam, because I'm just a scientist. So whatever, man.
It doesn't do good things for the credibility of the podcast. The Science Facts and Fallacies podcast with Cameron English and Scam Likely.
SourceWatch is going to put that up.
Look, he admits it.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Okay. All right. Well, let's get into some stories. So first up, health impacts of chemicals doubled in the last 5 years. Media misrepresenting flawed studies to mislead the public on chemical safety. Next up, molecular farming. Edible plant-based vaccines are cheaper, easier, and quicker to produce than traditional shots. And finally, Henrietta Lacks' immortal genes are now the subject of a legal battle. All right, Kevin, first up, what are we talking about here when you say the health impacts of chemicals? That sounds kind of broad to me.
Yeah, well, this is a story by Jeffrey Cabot, and Jeffrey is an epidemiologist, a cancer epidemiologist, and exquisite statistician who has been reporting on the misuse of meta-analyses and broader analyses for years, and he does a brilliant job at this, and we should all thank him for it. This one is an extension of what he always talks about, and when certain surveys or published work says, well, we're at more risk now than we ever were before, and that it's doubled in the last 5 years. You really have to think about it as a consumer. Has it really doubled in the last 5 years? When we look at where we were in the quote good old days with, you know, organophosphate chemistry on the farm, organochlorides in the home for insect control, you know, we've come a long way to make things safer. And so when you automatically respond to, or when you see a title like the health impacts have doubled in the last 5 years, and then they're assuming negative health impacts, you really got to have a red flag go off. And Cabot really talks about what that means. And what he's really looked at is a series of meta-analyses, which is where you take all the current work that's available, put it into a blender, a statistical blender, and say, do we see significance and concordance between multiple studies that can reinforce the statistical observations within a single study. So if we see some association in one, maybe we can build on that association by showing this is something consistent across many. And that's a really powerful thing when it's done correctly. The problem is that there's too many folks who are able to grab headlines by reporting underpowered meta-analyses. And that's really what this story is about, is that it really comes from a CNN headline that reported on a certain study that began at NYU, where they really say, well, synthetic chemicals are harmful and everywhere, and endocrine disruptors are the big problem. They're in plastics, pesticides, flame retardants, blah, blah, blah. And really talking about this being a significant consumer problem. The issue really is, though, when you go back to those individual studies that made up the meta-analysis, did they really say that? And what Cabot points out is that there's incredible inconsistency between the different studies, how powerful they are they powerful at all, and do they really say what the meta-analysis says? And then that is that people are more exposed than they ever have been before. That's really the thrust of the article.
And here's one example, and maybe we've discussed this before, but he talks about the association, the supposed association between intellectual deficits in children and exposure to organophosphate pesticides. And in this meta-analysis that he's reviewing, there were four studies involved. Two of them found some sort of a statistically significant association, and two others didn't. But the authors of the review nonetheless said this is strong evidence of a link between pesticide exposure and intellectual deficits. So one thing that I see a lot in studies like this when I review them is that in the technical analysis of what they actually did for the research, they reach one conclusion and they tell you, you know, this was statistically insignificant, or there's some variable that skews our results in some way. But then when you get to the discussion section of the conclusion, they go, therefore, you know, this is clear evidence of something that's harmful. Yeah. So I don't really understand how that happens, but I guess my only point would be people need to be aware that that's often what's going on if you can just click through to the journal article itself.
Yeah, and it's what we call overstepping the data. And we, you know, as reviewers, and when I review a paper, I'm very, very sensitive to this. If you make a claim that doesn't fit with the data, we tone down the language or say, you know, it's tempting to speculate that the data that we've seen could be interpreted to say, you know, that's one thing. But coming to the conclusion that there is some palpable level of risk, which especially can be reported by the media as an imminent risk, is something we have to be really careful about. And I should just put out the caveat that it's important to say that, yes, there are chemistries that are out there that do pose a risk. And we know that, you know, and this is something that we're aware of and something we should be careful of. And it's not just saying, you know, all chemicals are good, not by any stretch of the imagination. But what it says is that we have to be extremely careful when we start to look at these analyses that are widely picked up by the major media and ask serious questions about where are the data that they are made from come from? And do those data really tell the story that the authors are telling? And that's what, you know, Jeffrey Cabot's thesis really is with this article.
And it's so frustrating too, and he talks about this as well in the story, but sometimes our ability to detect a chemical someplace or some exposure is better than our ability to understand how that exposure might impact your health. And so because we're so good at finding chemicals everywhere, we make this unjustified leap in many cases to say, well, you know, if you were to drink this stuff, it would kill you in 30 seconds. Therefore, if there's, you know, a very tiny quantity of it in your pizza box or wherever, you know, this, you know, in 30 years, your kid's not going to be able to read as quickly as they would have been able to previously. It's like, it's just these relationships. They can't possibly know. It has to be speculative by necessity. And I remember when he was on the show, we talked about this with him, and he just said that we're getting into this place where I think it's called lifestyle factor epidemiology, We're like all the low hanging fruit has been picked in terms of, you know, smoking and HPV and certain cancers and so all this stuff has been uncovered. And so now they're just like digging in the sand to find anything. And there may be something there, but more times than not, it's not anything.
Yeah, but that's the important point, is that it may be there, and it may be this kind of meta-analysis that uncovers it. So I'm not dismissing this out of hand. But what I am saying is that we all have to be extremely careful when we're confronted with major media claims based upon a meta-analysis, because until you go back and look at it carefully and look at the sources of the original data, it's extremely hard to tell or to vet the validity of that meta-analysis. That's the major take-home message. And we've seen it abused with glyphosate. We've seen it abused with other cases where they take data sets that really can't be compared because different timelines, different dosages, and then shove them all together to show some sort of a statistically significant effect. And I should clear this out too, just for what it's worth. You can have a statistically significant effect, which means that the chances of it being real are 95% based upon your analysis and the data that you combined. That doesn't mean the data that you combined really could be combined. And so that caveat is really important. And so they'll say, okay, the results were significant. And on CNN, Robin Mead will say, there are significant data that say this. But to me as a biologist, is statistical significance the same thing as biological significance? You see what I'm saying? Like, you can say the numbers tell us that maybe it does, but the biology, there's no way that this could happen. And so there's two very different thresholds here that you have to be extremely careful about when you talk about a meta-analysis. And this is stuff that Dr. Cabot talks about all the time. And in this case, does a very nice job at explaining why we need to be careful when we're confronted with such studies in major media.
Exactly, Kevin. Exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself. So molecular farming. What is that? Let's start with that title before we jump into the story. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I think what they're talking about is the production of specific molecules in plants for use in treatment of human disease. So instead of pulling off a leaf or a flower or a fruit, you're farming the molecules within that plant. And this really goes back to, and I should mention, the original article was by Amanda Winkler and talks about how do they make edible, or I should say, is the idea of an edible vaccine viable, and what's happening with plant-based vaccines? And I believe on this podcast a few years ago, we talked about an Ebola vaccine that was generated in tobacco. And they used tobacco because Benthamiana strain of tobacco is an extremely good plant to produce a protein you tell it to produce. So if we wanted to produce a vaccine, say the co-protein to the flu virus, we could give that information to the tobacco plant and it would make boatloads of it. And they do this with what's called transient infiltration. So what you do is you take agrobacterium, which is a naturally occurring bacterium that gives a little piece of its DNA to the plant. And scientists give that agrobacterium a little piece of DNA with what we want it to produce. And then we soak the plants in the agrobacterium. We put them under a little bit of a vacuum. The leaves compress. And then when you release the vacuum, they suck up a little bit of the agrobacterium. There's a genetic exchange in the leaves. And now those leaves turn into factories for the protein you wish to produce. The beauty of this is that you can produce things like antigens for major diseases, like Ebola, influenza, Zika, COVID-19. SARS-CoV-2, I should say. And now you can inject those into humans and get an immune response. And that's what's been going on, that instead of raising vaccines the old way, where you had to grow virus in eggs, now you just grow the critical parts that are the signatures of viruses in plants. and apparently makes a safer and faster and more agile vaccine that can allow us to meet different challenges like SARS-CoV-2. So this is just another tool in the toolbox that now can be derived from plants instead of through synthetic means.
If I'm not mistaken, one of your postdocs works on this primarily. Is that right?
One of my postdocs has worked on this kind of thing. Yeah, we've done a couple different strategies to try to come up with novel molecules that can solve issues, but we do some stuff in this vein. Sure.
So is it mostly in like we talked about RNA interference last week and how that could be used to as an alternative to certain chemical pesticides in some contexts, but it's really not ready for commercialization yet. Is this kind of where this is? It's still in the developmental stage and you still have to do clinical trials and you still have to get approval in different countries and so forth?
Actually, I think this is extremely mature technology at this point. So there are two ways that you can think about this. Can you generate proteins in plants and then purify those proteins and then inject people with them? So instead of having to go to the old school way of raising a vaccine, which is culturing viruses in millions of chicken eggs, and then cracking open all those eggs, purifying out the virus, then inactivating the virus using different chemistries to break down the virus, then injecting the broken down virus as a vaccine, that's the normal way this is done. In this case, you're raising discrete proteins from the virus in plants and then purifying away those specific proteins that are you're still using as an injection. So you're injecting these into the body and causing some sort of a immune response to them. The ultimate idea by companies like Medicago and other companies is perhaps edible vaccines. And that's where people would eat the leaves. And I guess if you ate tobacco, well, that's a great vaccine. Can I have some more?
I mean, I got this tingly feeling in my brain all of a sudden. I think the vaccine's working.
That's actually kind of a funny idea. Yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it leads to a serious question though, and that is, like, how would this work in practice? Would you go to a CVS and instead of injecting you with a needle and your arm, they say, here's an apple slice and it's got your polio vaccine in it or whatever. Would it really be something like that? They would just distribute it as a little piece of leafy green vegetable or something?
Well, ultimately that's the idea, because there's a lot of places in the world that you can't send a vaccine because they don't have needles and syringes. You don't necessarily have the temperature to store it. Think about mRNA vaccines. They have to be stored at really cold temperatures. So what if we could supply vaccines either as the protein to be injected or as an edible vaccine? So eat this piece of sweet potato and it contains the protein that will stimulate your immune system against it as an antigen. The problem is the digestive system is pretty harsh against proteins that are present. So how do you either nanoencapsulate or otherwise protect the plant so that it survives digestion, gets into the bloodstream, and triggers an antigenic response? And that's the big challenge of edible vaccines.
Yeah, there's always one major challenge with any new technology, it seems, or at least one. But it would be great, I think. You know, like my son just had all his vaccines recently, and there's a few that are, or at least one of them that's an oral vaccine. And it's like, it's basically like a sugar water with, you know, the antigen in it or how, you know, whatever it is. And he takes that one fine. And then there's like four or five other shots that they just plug into his leg. And he's like, what the hell's going on here? You know? So it seems like a great idea to, and I'd be willing to bet that a lot of people who are afraid of needles come out as sort of like, well, I'm anti-vaccine and I have all these sciencey reasons. And in reality, they're just like, I don't want a needle in my arm. So it seems like there's a lot of value in this if it can move forward.
That's a really good point. And I really like it. The big issue on all of it is apathy more than anything. I guess you would say corporate apathy, that because you can already do it the old school way in the eggs, why change it? It's a whole nother layer of regulation, a whole nother level of ensuring that it's the correct product that's coming out and that it works. And what we have, if it, you know, it ain't broken, don't break it. But, you know, maybe one way to get SARS-CoV-2 compliance would be to, you know, put an edible vaccine in Doritos or Bud Light and you'd get the rest of them.
Oh, that'd be funny, man. I don't know. You might have people that have too much vaccination.
Or, yeah, put it in Mountain Dew. You'd be able to pick off all the resistant, hesitant. I think they share those associations with those products. So anyway, just a thought. If I may generalize.
That's ridiculous, but it's funny. Okay. Okay. So going from vaccinated Doritos to technically stealing somebody's cells from their body, what's the story about?
Yeah, this is a story about Henrietta Lacks. I knew HELA, H-E-L-A, for Henrietta Lacks. So the first two letters of her name and last two letters of her name, going way back into undergraduate times, because in biology, so many different processes were studied in HELA cells. And you never thought much about HELA, whatever that meant, but it really stood for Henrietta Lacks. Henrietta Lacks was a woman who in 1950 was at Johns Hopkins for treatment of cancer. And while she was under anesthesia, they took some of her cells. Might not be a big deal. Seemed like a thing that you might do. But Henrietta Lacks didn't realize that she would become, her cells would become, her genetics would become a model for the study of cancer and other biological processes for the next 60, 70 years. And here she is, alive in a Petri dish, really as the basis for discovery for things like polio vaccines, cloning human cells, in vitro fertilization, studies of that process, just even fundamental biology, like, you know, how many chromosomes humans have. All of this came from HeLa cells. And the problem here is really kind of an interesting ethical problem, maybe even an issue in racism. Henrietta Lacks was black, and she had her cells taken while she was under anesthesia. She gave permission to be treated, but the question is, did she really give permission to become immortalized in Petri dishes? She died a long time ago, 1950s. I mean, she died maybe even in, you know, shortly after her cells were harvested. But her family really is asking hard questions. Shouldn't we have some sort of benefit or financial stake in these cells that are shaping the discovery center for all these gigantic corporations to profit from a sick relative in our ancestry? It's a really interesting ethical question.
Yeah, it is. And it scares the hell out of me. And by the way, we should just say, so this is an article by Barbara Pfeffer Billauer, I believe is how you pronounce the name, but she writes for the organization I work for, ACSH, and she's a bona fide bioethicist. So she tackles all these interesting questions. And she makes the point in the article that the family has kind of messed up on this in an ethical sense, because their concern has, well, at least some people in the family have been concerned about getting compensation from this. And the more interesting question that Barbara points out is the more fundamental one, which is, you know, in what sense do you have bodily autonomy? Because this strikes me as really unethical for someone to come in for a cancer treatment and then for you to take literally a portion of them and do whatever you will with it, even if the results are good in the long term. I don't know that kind of strikes me as dangerous, you know, cause if you were asleep and I took $50 out of your wallet and I bought homeless people food and then they went on and lived fulfilling, productive lives because I was kind enough to buy him a burrito or something, it would still be theft on my part, right? I still took money that was yours, and it wouldn't matter that I had pure motivations or that I did something good with it. You know, I still stole from you. So I don't know. There's a lot of edges to this. I mean, what's your take on that initial question? Like the reality of them taking something from her that did not belong to them.
Well, it was wrong. And you don't do this. And I don't think these days this wouldn't happen. But back then it was something that you were, you know, if especially if you're a researcher, here's an opportunity to observe immortalized cell lines. And I could put myself, because cancer cells usually don't die. That's one, you know, property of them. They're what they call immortalized cell lines. And I would think that if you were a cancer researcher, you may say, let's grab a few cells because they will help us understand this cancer better. And so I'm not looking at nefarious motivations for the people that did the harvesting. I think they did the right thing. And maybe I would have done the same thing in 1952 is, you know, let's try to understand this disease better so it can benefit her and all of humanity. More recently, I think the Talking Biotech podcast, if I can toot my own horn, we're featuring a story on a woman who donated her brain because she had a rare cancer and upon death wanted others to benefit from her suffering and her condition. And the analysis of her, of the tumor in her brain, her unusual brain tumor, has seeded all kinds of discovery that will help others going forward. So the ethical issue with Henrietta Lacks was, yes, this was the wrong thing to do in terms of the immediate decision by the physician who was making those decisions. However, when you look at the people it served and the amount of scientific progress that Ms. Lacks has contributed to posthumously, it really is a question of, you know, we really have to be careful of making our intentions clear and potentially offering these opportunities to study our resources after we are no longer using them. And I think that the discussion of Henrietta Lacks and her cells really open an important discussion we all need to have.
Without a doubt. My broader question, though, is, was there anything unique about her cells specifically? Because I imagine lots of people get cancer and have had cancer, you know, even in the 1950s. So couldn't you have just done this with someone, like go to someone and say, hey, we think your cells would be enormously useful for decades of medical research, and you could potentially save millions of lives or prevent millions of cases of different diseases or what have you. Why couldn't you do that instead of engaging in something like this, which sounds, yeah. I mean, I don't, maybe it wasn't illegal technically. I think Barbara says that you could make a case that this is some kind of a fraud to do this to people, to tell them you're putting them under for one thing and then doing something in addition. So yeah, I mean, couldn't you just say, oh, you know, you have cancer, we're going to treat it. And by the way, if we can take some of these cells and study them, then a lot of good could come from that. Why couldn't you just do that?
Yeah, you know, you're asking me to get into the brain of a physician in 1950 who was curious about solving a problem for somebody. And you know, I can't even begin to fathom what was in that physician's mind at the time. And I would like to think that it was an altruistic idea of, this is a problem that we need to solve, so can we take these cells and try to solve it? If not for Ms. Lacks, for others from, you know, beyond her. And so that's why this is such a touchy question, because, you know, really, she's immortal and she will go on to help many people in the future. So why would we get too upset about that? And I understand the family's point, you know, and especially when the Henrietta Lacks thing has become part of a discussion, even on movies and documentaries, like Oprah made one about Henrietta Lacks, and her family didn't get a piece of that pie. Actually, they declined to be part of the production team. But this is an important part of that discussion. When does this start to seem like exploitation of a family member's posthumous resources? And I think that's the major question that they have to solve.
Tough stuff. This bioethical stuff is very, very difficult. And I don't know. I don't know. I think at minimum, we need to get better at talking about it to the public. And, you know, like coming out of a pandemic, you have so many people enraged over vaccine mandates and lockdowns. And then we have these discussions where like, you know, maybe we should make people sequence their baby's genome because we said so. It's like, like all these, I don't know. It seems like there's people that like, they see all of these technical possibilities and they want to, they're like, but we're good and we're trying to change the world for the better. So if you don't like it, shut up. And it's just, I don't know. I'm ranting a little bit on a non-podcasting day, but I think you can appreciate my concern.
But this is my point, is that this is not a science problem. This is a science communication problem. And this is the thing that I pound the table about and scream about all the time. Okay, eggheads, you can do something cool, but can you please, before you start harvesting someone's cells, can you communicate about why it's important and talk about the contribution this person will make or whatever? Give us that first rather than 70 years later trying to deal with fallout from your decision. And we need to have that upfront transparency and communication when we do this. And I'm not allowed to talk about that. So, which is really the irony, you know, here we're in a position where more transparency and more science communication might be the equalizer. Yet that is the thing that those of us in public universities are being steered away from.
Yeah, that's stupid. I don't work for university, so I can say that that's collectively and universally stupid. If there's any chancellors listening, that's dumb. So more broadly, I think what frustrates me, I agree with you 100%. If you're trying to convince someone or change their mind or get their compliance with something, engaging them and asking them questions is a great way to do that. The concern I have when I talk to anybody who's involved in this field, the general opinion, well, from the people I've spoken with, they'll say this is inevitable to a certain extent. So we need to recognize that it's inevitable, but then we also need to engage the public in dialogue, and we need to tell them how important it is that they participate because democracy makes happiness flourish or blah, whatever, you know. But in other words, my frustration is it's not a real conversation. You're not engaging people because you want to find out if they really want this. You're trying to appease them before you do what you're going to do anyway. And that's the part that bugs me. Does that make sense?
Well, totally. Because, you know, we as experts sometimes feel as though things should go the way we think they should because we're experts, right? Everybody should be vaccinated. You know, and that's how we really feel as a scientific community. Yet when you start to mandate it, now you're starting to violate human psychology, which means fewer people will be vaccinated. So what's more important? Is it you pushing your mandate and ensure, you know, and codifying your mandate by firing people or whatever? Or is it getting what you want in the end by having better communication strategically where you're able to get people on board with what you need to get done? And that's been a huge thing that COVID has illuminated and something I've taken a great deal of interest in because I think we can do better at how we motivate people to do the right thing.
Absolutely. We agree on that. I just think I'm destined to become a crusty, angry old man on my porch with a Pabst Blue Ribbon in my hand, just mad about everything. That's the only conclusion I can reach. But
yeah. So you're worried about becoming me in 15 minutes.
Yeah, I'll have my shotgun and my Pabst and listen to Johnny Cash, and people will come up and try to talk to me about Jesus, and I'll say, "Get off my lawn."
Oh, I never say get off my lawn. I just scream get. Get.
We don't need to bring actual language into this. Just my random shouting noises.
No, an expletive and a gunpoint usually are pretty persuasive. You know, the chunk of the 12 gauge, you know, that right there, you know, you get people don't come on the lawn very often.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to jump off so Kevin can go drink his beer and shout at people from his porch. Who are you following on Twitter, Kevin?
So I have a good one. This is at UF_space_plants, UF space plants. And if you're into plant biology, even if you're just a gardener or whatever, check out what they're doing, because they're talking about the unusual things that happen to plants when you grow them in outer space, either in the microgravity of the ISS and the minimal gravity of Mars, or zero gravity of outer space, just in between the two. How do plants respond to these unusual environmental stresses that they have no evolutionary program to deal with? And I talked to Dr. Annalisa Paul this week on my podcast. She's the principal person at UF Space Plants. It's a great follow. And they're doing a lot of very interesting things to study how biology behaves in outer space, because we're going to need it there before we can go explore. How about you?
That's crazy stuff, man. I found out recently that that movie, The Martian with Matt Damon, was quite accurate in terms of the botany and the different sciences involved. So it's like, it's not that far off from reality. So anyways, I just think that's cool that there's finally movies that are actually portraying something that's scientifically plausible.
Yeah. Well, we're the botanist is the good guy, right? Because in every other movie, the scientist is the idiot who, you brought the Tyrannosaurus back to life, right? Or, from Frankenstein to Jurassic Park, the scientist is always the jerk who wrecks it. And in this case, the scientist was the protagonist. There you go.
Yeah, that's good stuff. In any event, I'm going to recommend people follow Matt Ridley, who is a science writer. He's written so many awesome books. If you haven't read The Red Queen, it's awesome. It's all about the history of, not the history of how the theory of evolution developed, but like literally how evolution occurred and how it continues to influence our behavior and, how we behave in the world today. It's really, really good book, but he's written a bunch of books and it just has a really good perspective on innovation and technology. And I've learned a lot from him. So he is at Matt Ridley on Twitter. Excuse me. There's a W in there. Matt W. Ridley.
And a crazy new one on the lab leak hypothesis.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy because in most cases he takes all the conventional standard opinions on most things because they're usually correct, but on a couple of issues he says, I have a different perspective and here's why. And because it's someone of his caliber, I can't just go, well, he's obviously nuts. He's not Joe Mercola or the Organic Consumers Association. So you can't say like, oh, well, you're just kind of crazy. So, I need to read that book, but anyways, disagree with them, love them, hate them. Just follow them. If anything, you'll learn something. And that's gonna do it for us. So thank you guys at Kevin Folta on Twitter, at ACSH.org on Twitter to follow my writing, geneticliteracyproject.org. And we will see you next week.